MUSETER at MUSEUMCA.org or at 510-238-3514. Participants must be 12 or older. Bring your own bikes, helmets, and repair kits and meet at the main entrance to the Oakland Museum on 1000 Oak Street at 10 a.m. And guess what? It's free. This public service announcement was brought to you by your friends at Pirate Cat Radio.
Cat listeners, welcome to Techno for Science. This is DJ Rooch, as always, kicking off with a Parrot Fractales Part 1. Got a lot of good show for you today, some new music. Also have Brian Mossop stopping in the studio. He used to be a writer for Wired, is now coordinating science blogs for Public Library of Science. We'll chat about some of the recent articles that he's been coordinating and writing himself. Stay tuned for that. Shoot me a call. The number in the studio is 415-341-1199. That's 415-341-1199. Or stop by the cafe at the corner of 21st and Florida. Got some delicious coffee drinks, the famous bacon maple latte. All right, let's get back to the music. This is Techno for Science. We'll be right back.
that knocks you down.
Welcome back, Pirate Cat listeners. This is DJ Rooch. You're listening to Techno for Science. Right now, this is Gold Panda with India Lately on his latest album, Lucky Shiner, on Ghostly International. Excellent album. Highly recommend picking that one up. Before that was Chromeo with I'm Not Contagious, Business Casual. Before that was Time Rider with his latest album, Tiefenschauen, and that track was Paso Doble. Time Rider always consistently produces some of the best deep house out there. In just a few minutes, we'll be chatting with Brian Mossop of Wired and Public Library of Science. Stay tuned for that. Shoot me a call, 415-341-1199, or stop by the cafe at 21st and Florida. You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, www.piratecatradio.com, and this is Techno for Science. Let's get back to the music. We'll be right back.
Some health tips for this Thanksgiving holiday. Don't go to the Thanksgiving dinner hungry. We often eat faster and more when we are hungry. Therefore, breakfast and lunch on the day to avoid overeating at dinner time. Thanksgiving dinner is not an all-you-can-eat buffet. Fill your plate half with starch of your choice. Side dishes. Watch your portion size. Go for the smaller portions. This way you can sample all the different foods. Make a conscious choice to limit high-fat items. High-fat food items can be found and creamy dishes, as well as cheese-filled casseroles in a traditional Thanksgiving meal. Drink plenty of water. Fill up your stomach and keep hydrated. Have a happy and healthy Thanksgiving holiday. This is brought to you from Pirate Cat Radio.
All right, Pirate Cat listeners. Welcome back. Hope you enjoyed that Gold Panda track. In the studio now is Brian Mossop, one of my colleagues at the Public Library of Science. Welcome, Brian. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Not at all. So I'm very excited to talk to you. We don't get a chance to talk so much in the office.
Right.
But you do lots of interesting things. You're running the PLOS blog network. So PLOS is the acronym for Public Library of Science.
That's right.
And we are the open access publishers, one of the leaders in that business model. And Brian came on as, why don't you go ahead and describe it, Brian?
Sure. So I was hired about 3 or 4 months ago now as the community manager at the Public Library of Science. So initially we had a product called PLOS Hubs, which was the idea of taking all the most relevant and new research in a particular area, grouping it together on a website and giving researchers access to all the all the hot new information that's in their field. And these sites are curated by leaders in the field. So what you're really getting is kind of hand-selected material from well-respected experts. So your researchers can go and find out what's new and interesting from some really well-respected people.
Right.
So that project was slated to launch on October 1st. But right around the time when I started, actually 2 weeks after I started, there's a big to-do at Science Blogs, which was, you know, the eminent science blogging network out there. They had a bunch of people leave for various reasons, and PLOS just felt that it was a good time to get involved in the blogosphere. So very quickly put together this idea of launching our own blog network as a nonprofit organization. We kind of have a unique angle. There was no advertisements on the site at all. So we couldn't pay our bloggers, but it kind of eliminated this potential conflict of interest of us making money from ads that could conflict with someone's ideologies.
So I've always wondered about this, and this is, what exactly was Science Blogs? Because everyone had their own blog. They were individuals. So what service did Science Blogs as an organization provide?
Right. Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, anybody can start a blog, right? I mean, you can go to Google's platform, Blogger, Blogspot, whatever, and start your own blog, WordPress.com. But there's kind of this interesting phenomenon when you group together in a network, it kind of becomes a one-stop shop place for people to go look for information. And as you gain popularity and readership, people who blog tend to get more hits in these aggregate networks than they do on their own, which makes sense. And then there's cool things like most of these networks are indexed by Google News. So now your blog posts are potentially coming up in Google News search results, which again translates into more readers coming to your blog.
Excellent. And so what did PLOS Blogs want to take from it, and what did it want to avoid from that model?
Yeah, I mean, the big thing at Science Blogs, the elephant in the room, is that they let Pepsi have their own blog. And Pepsi was an ad sponsor at the time. Now they gave them their own editorial on the website. And a lot of people viewed that as a conflict of interest. You know, there was this blurring the lines between an advertiser and an editorial voice on the network.
Right.
So right off the bat, we said, well, let's just avoid this whole advertisement deal altogether and just do no ads on the network. So, I mean, we don't make any money by running PLOS Blogs. We view this as a service to the public. You know, one of PLOS's missions is to disseminate science to the public. And although we publish great journals, as you know, I mean, really getting to the public requires a different type of voice.
Absolutely.
And so the blogs, what we did was we really wanted to recruit a unique bunch, and we split it right down the middle. We recruited 50% science journalists and 50% researchers who have really good writing skills.
Yeah.
So it's this unique mix of scientists and journalists. And that really creates an interesting vibe on the network that a lot of people have commented on and really like. You know, they say we have a youthful and current vibe, which is great. I mean, that's what we want to do. We want to kind of, you know, push the boundaries and make this unique. So that's kind of the approach we took when we went into it.
So tell me a little bit about the subject areas and the people involved in PLOS Blogs.
Sure. Yeah. We wanted to start small, manageable, and then potentially grow from there. So we launched 11 blogs to start. We pulled in people who were blogging neuroscience to obesity research to, you know, chemistry and everyday life. We pulled in a really solid core of journalists, a Pulitzer Prize winner. Really solid researchers, scientists, who just had done a phenomenal job explaining their own research and the research of their colleagues to the public.
That's great. Any recent ones that caught a lot of attention? Can you think of any articles or posts recently that a lot of people kind of, it spoke to them?
Yeah. I think there's several really unique things that you'll see in our network. Steve Silberman, who runs NeuroTribes, is the name of his blog. He's really kind of transforming what blogging means. He's not just telling his opinion on things. He's actually doing original reporting on a blog platform, and it's just been very popular. People love it. His introductory post to the network when we launched on September 1st was an interview with Oliver Sacks, and it was the first time that Oliver Sacks had talked about his battle with ophthalmic cancer and talked about his new book. I mean, it was breaking news at the time.
Yeah,
and
that's
this is done on a blogging platform. So I think that we're really trying to redefine what it means. We don't want blogs to be just about opinions. We want to really be scientific commentary that's meaningful.
Excellent. So tell me a little bit about your background, academic, and then also what kind of got you into science journalism and communication, and, you know, what brought you to PLOS?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, my training is kind of all over the place. I started as an undergraduate in electrical engineering, but I'm really reluctant to tell people that because then they expect me to be able to do things that I can't do, like wire things together.
Right. And fix the toilet, Brian.
Right. So I'm really reluctant to tell people that. But I did start my career as an electrical engineer. But realized really quickly that the biomedical science and biomedical engineering was really what interested me the most. So I went to graduate school at Duke University. I finished a PhD in biomedical engineering, focusing on electrophysiology in 2006. I moved out to California to do a postdoc at UCSF. Switched over to basic neuroscience at that point. I really wanted to learn about the brain. Electrophysiology piqued my interest during grad school, but I really wanted to learn about, you know, the basic functioning of the brain. Loved the research, but I realized really quickly into my postdoc that research was not for me. I just didn't see myself as a career as a professor. So I really, at that point, I started thinking about what I really liked about graduate school, and surprisingly, the number one thing that I really liked in graduate school is writing my thesis. And as I started telling people this, that did a dissertation or were in graduate school, they looked at me like I was crazy, and I never really put all that together that was unique.
Yeah. So no, it's funny because now in my job now, I'm surrounded by people who all were like, I just loved writing and reading papers. And whereas in grad school, everyone was like, that's ridiculous.
Right. So maybe I was just in the wrong kind of, with the wrong group of people. I was with researchers who really liked doing, you know, day after day lab work.
Yeah.
And it's
more power to them.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, they do a fantastic job, and I would love telling people about what cool things were going on in my lab more than I would like doing the experiments myself.
Definitely. So, I know that sentiment.
So, you know, one thing led to another. I left UCSF and I decided to finish my postdoctoral training at Genentech. I wasn't in their postdoctoral program. I was actually a full-time employee as a senior research associate, but the job function was pretty much the same as a postdoc. It was a training position.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I was in a neuroscience lab. I was just trying to round out my training while I figured out how to move into the scientific communication full-time. Around the same time, this is around 2008, I started doing, trying to do some writing in a more official capacity. I reached out to Wired Magazine's executive editor Thomas Goetz, who was kind enough to offer me a spot on his blog to start getting my foot in the door doing some writing. And ended up being a really good mentor for me to learn how to do science writing properly.
Great.
So I did that for a while, and just kind of went from there slowly but surely. Started doing gadget reviews for Wired Magazine. That was my first official publication. And then slowly started working more on the website side, which is what I'm doing now. So I contribute to Wired.com's column called Playbook, which is really about the intersection of sports, technology, and science.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of cool. It presents a unique opportunity for me as an employee at PLOS to really highlight some cool things that are going on in our journals.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, PLOS One consistently has really interesting papers about sports science, neuroscience, how it relates to athletic competition, hormones of competition, and it just gives me a way to write about this and get the word out there of
That's really cool. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about the one title I saw recently about Bend It Like Beckham. Did you guys cover that, or do you know about this paper?
No, I did not. I did not cover that. And I'm actually embarrassed to say I didn't even consider that one. Maybe I should be asking you about that
one. No, I think it was the looking at parameters of visual perception that relate to kicking a soccer ball.
Oh.
You know, what is it about the curvature of a ball and the velocity and the trajectory that makes it hard to block a spinning kick from X distance away?
Right. Yeah. I do remember that paper. We didn't cover that one, but we covered one very similar that was also in PLOS One. It was about the trajectory of a curveball.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. So mathematically speaking, a curveball follows a straight curve. It's a parabola. It doesn't have any disjointed motion. But from the batter's perspective, all of a sudden at the last minute, they see this thing have vertical drop.
Uh-huh.
You know,
because the parabola is horizontal in the axis.
Exactly. So it should follow this smooth curve. But from the batter's perception, they actually see this thing have a disjointed motion. It's the notorious break of a curveball, as the players call it. Researchers in PLOS One showed that this is actually a visual illusion. It doesn't really happen.
Yeah.
It's just in how the batter perceives it, and it has to do with how the ball is traveling from the outside, from the peripheral vision to the central vision and back again.
It's not just from the retina. It requires the central nervous system.
Yes. Okay. So it's when players' eyes move and the image itself moves from the peripheral vision to the center or vice versa. That information kind of gets jumbled up in the brain. And it appears as if it's displacing vertically, but it's not.
Very cool.
Yeah.
For the listeners, I didn't mean to geek out too hard. The visual illusions can happen at multiple stages of visual processing. Many of them are shown to just happen in the retina, like just the retinal ganglion cells and the photoreceptors and the bipolar cells and X, blah, blah, blah. There's just types of circuits in the retina that cause illusions, but there's also ones that need higher processing in the brain. So that's why I was asking. Speaking of baseball, you recently wrote a baseball one, and this is funny because during the World Series, I was complaining to my girlfriend about how silly it was that all these players wore these necklaces, and she called me very judgmental since I didn't know what I was talking about. But now I have an article to point to that this is actually silly. Yeah. So why don't you tell me about this article you wrote in Wired recently?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was kind of the same thing. I mean, everybody kind of saw these big twisted ropes around players' necks as you're watching the playoff games and the World Series. And nobody really, a lot of people didn't know what they were. Some thought that they were some sort of charity event, you know, they were supporting some sort of charity, and others thought it was just a fashion statement. But really what it's manufactured by a company called Phiten, Phiten.
Mm-hmm.
And the rope itself is soaked in what they call aqua titanium. So they take titanium metal, break it apart into really small particles. It becomes water soluble. They soak these ropes in the titanium water, titanium solution. And they market this product as having health benefits. So they claim that wearing titanium products realigns the ions of your body. And it gives you the ability to compete longer, to have less fatigue, faster recovery. And a lot of people had covered this in the media, and it was all conjecture, really. People just offered their opinions on this. This can't possibly work. But nobody really looked at kind of the science and technology behind it.
Yeah.
So we had a unique opportunity. I pitched the story to my editor at Wired Playbook, and you know, he said, "Yeah, this is great. If you want to do this, go ahead." But there was one caveat: it was getting towards the end of the World Series, and the Giants were already up 2-0, and it was the weekend, and so we were concerned that the Giants were going to sweep the series, and then on Monday baseball season would be over. It'd be too late to run the story.
Yeah.
So even though I'm a San Francisco resident right now, I was secretly hoping that they would let it go one more game so that we could run the story on Monday. And that's actually what ended up happening. You know, they lost on Saturday, so on Sunday I just sat down and wrote this story, and it actually ended up being pretty interesting. There's several patents filed on this technology by the company around the processing of the rope itself. There was only one scientific study that I could find, and basically it said that the results were inconclusive. They couldn't show scientifically that this makes you be able to perform any better or recover any faster.
Uh-huh.
And that's pretty much what I reported. But nobody else had really kind of looked at the science behind it. Like I said, it was all pretty much opinion pieces.
So where did they claim that the imbalance of ions resides, and how would a necklace around your neck retain that balance or reinstate that balance.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I compared it to, kind of the science behind Gatorade, which is actually, there's a ton of science behind the Gatorade Research Institute. Which
yeah. That's real science.
That's real science. Yeah. So, I mean, when you exercise, your ions do go out of balance, right? Through, when you sweat, you're losing, electrolytes and water. And so they're claiming that this ion imbalance from physical activity itself can be readjusted with titanium. It really was just a claim like that. On the website, it's more or less like, of course this would work. Why wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But like I said, we really wanted to try to find something. And did they file any peer-reviewed papers on this? And the one we found said, well, it doesn't really show anything. They said this requires further analysis. The people exhibit no faster recovery than the other.
That's amazing because so many players had them.
They do.
It was all these kids are going to want their parents to buy them for them now.
And I think we priced it out on the Playbook article. I think we priced it out. I think it was like $36 a piece for uh-huh. these necklaces. I mean, for the average person, that's a chunk of change, right? For a necklace that you're wearing for athletic performance. But the funny thing was, I mean, shortly after the article went live, I actually got an email from the company, from Fyton, and they said they read the article and they actually thanked me for, doing the research behind the necklace itself. Mm-hmm. And they said basically the same thing. Everyone else just offered their opinion, but nobody really stated the facts. So that was kind of cool that, the company, even though I debunked their product more or less, and still recognized that it was good journalism and good research.
Oh, good for you. That's great. It does remind me, there's these things come and go. I feel like, the magnetic necklaces and, whatever showing that it creates some electrical or magnetic force that it actually helps your cognitive or physical abilities. I don't think there's ever in 50 years of these things being around been a real study that shows that it's true.
it's what I did. The last two paragraphs of that article, I did kind of allude to the fact that, this could be just a mental crutch for these people. And believing something works and is a magic charm or a lucky charm, as you call it, is real for that person.
Yeah,
you know, there was an article in Scientific American a few weeks ago that showed that when somebody believes in something, it believes in a placebo effect, believes in something that doesn't make any sense on why this would make you better, faster, stronger. But when you believe in that, it creates a certain mental edge, and that's real. So maybe it doesn't matter. If it doesn't do anything physically, if it's helping these people mentally, who cares? I'm sure the players don't care if it's realigning the ions in their body, but it makes a big difference to them to have this mental crutch.
If it concretely affects their confidence,
exactly,
then that's a real thing.
Exactly.
No, it's cool. Yeah, the placebo effect, it's phenomenal. It's so interesting from a neuroscientific standpoint,
right?
How that
right.
works. Yeah. Very cool. So what else is going on at Playbook right now? Like, how long when did you guys start, and what are the projects that you guys are hoping to kind of complete?
Playbook is one of the newest. I'm reluctant to say it is the newest, but it started maybe a year ago. And Eric Malinowski is the staff reporter over there and also serves as my editor.
At Wired.
At Wired, yeah, for mm-hmm. external contributors. So, I mean, I've only been contributing there for about 3 months. So I'm fairly new contributor. But Eric kind of maintains the day-to-day. And, he really has this vision of presenting new commentary, new findings on the science and technology behind sports. So I'd recommend, anyone who's interested in those domains to go check it out, because it is the eminent source of that information on the net.
Awesome. So that's wired.com/playbook. /playbook. Excellent. And where can people find out more information about you and your writings?
Yeah. My home blog is, thedecisiontree.com. And there's an about page there that I have several writing clips, some things I did at Wired, some things I did at Scientific American, and I keep that updated. So that has my bio and most of my clips on there.
Awesome. Anything recent or even exciting or that you're really proud of? Do you want to talk about some recent articles that you had?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that... The articles that we talked about were really the most exciting ones that I've written personally. And I think that there's exciting things going on at PLOS Blogs every day. So I would suggest to check that out as well. So that's blogs.plos.org. And you can check out our readers, our writers, and always have some interesting things to say.
Absolutely. No, I highly recommend it to anyone listening. It's a fantastic source of really interesting information every day. There's a lot of topics covered, and it's really high quality writing also. So that's PLOS, blogs.plos.org, and also thedecisiontree.com. Anything else you want to talk about, Brian?
I think that's all I had. I mean, I'll answer your questions if you have any more.
Oh no, I just love chatting about the stuff you've written, because it's all really exciting.
Yeah,
and no, it's great to have you at PLOS, and I look forward to what's going on with the blogs and hubs.
Great, thanks for the invite.
Absolutely, thanks so much. That's Brian Mossop from Wired and Public Library of Science. You're listening to Techno for Science. This is DJ Rooch. I'm going to close things out with a little bit more music. Stay tuned. Pirate Cat listeners. This is DJ Rooch signing off of Techno for Science tonight. Finishing off with Johannes Heil, A Hollow Static on Loving. Before that was Brian Eno with Two Forms of Anger on his fantastic new album, Small Craft on a Milk Sea on Warp. Warp has been on a complete tear this year. Everything they put out is excellent. And before that was Kaiser Disco with Marie off of their new album, In No One's Shadow, also an excellent house techno album. That's it for me. Shay's Kitchen is coming up next. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening. This is Pirate Cat Radio, www.piratecatradio.com. It's DJ Rooch signing off. Till next time, Techno for Science.
make my head.